And you're listening to CKLM. This is Saturday Morning Live. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali. We were listening to Curtis Mayfield, Sam Gooden, and Fred Cash, The Impressions. They did a song called We're a Winner. And when Curtis first recorded that song, he had a line in there about getting rid of Uncle Tom's, and Johnny Pate made him take that out. That was in the 60s. And Curtis Mayfield at that point was like everybody else. He was into the movement. And when he passed away, he was still into the movement, but they made him change those lyrics. I have it somewhere, the original version. I want to get to that. And joining me in the studio is Melinda. And Melinda Francis had just come back from, as Rap Brown said, she came back from Detroit, and Rap Brown says that they used to call it Detroit. Now they call it Destroyed, and the only thing left is Smokey. And he's a miracle, and Smokey's no longer even in Detroit. So how is Detroit now?
Detroit. I mean, there's many things about Detroit. I'm always amazed when I go to Detroit, because despite all the destruction or all the abandoned buildings, there's still tons of music culture in the city, and that kind of amazes me how that's still alive. So anyway, that was like one of my reasons of going to Detroit. I'm starting this this documentary around that aspect. Like, why is it that there's still, despite like lack of community development, why is there so much music that still happens there?
Well, I was definitely not putting Detroit down, because I lived there for many years, and I consider Detroit my second home, because I lived in Detroit for many, many years. And at one point, Detroit was the fifth largest city in the United States, and now it's 9 or 10 possibly, but and that has something to do with the fact that Detroit completely lost its manufacturing base, and you know, people are moving, I guess, to Houston, Texas, moving to Denver, Colorado, Atlanta, Georgia, I guess. But what do you find people, when you talk to people, why are people saying that they're staying in Detroit?
Well, there's a core of hardcore Detroiters who still want to build Detroit and keep it going. So there's still a lot of militancy in Detroit, and a lot of, you know, small, independent, community-minded people there still trying to build an alternative. So yes, there's a lot of people leaving, but there are a few people that are still not sort of forgetting Detroit or giving up on it. I guess I should just tell a little bit about my trip. I went to see the Detroit Electronic Music Festival, which is a festival that happens every year. So I went there to document that. Going over the thing, I lived in Windsor for a while, so I kind of know Detroit a lot. I know a lot of people there in and around the area. I ended up staying with friends that I met a couple of years ago at the Allied Media Conference. So it was interesting because a lot of them are like community activists. So I got like a lot of backgrounder on the new governor in Michigan, who is horrible. and also like little things that I didn't know before. For example, the Ambassador Bridge, which is like one of the biggest trade crossings in North America. And I don't know why I didn't know this before, but it's owned by one guy. So all the profits that go cross that crossing is goes to one family. Yeah, so it's owned by one guy. I actually have the name of the family. They're basically billionaires. It's American Maroon. Wait, hold on, I have the name. Yeah, the family is the Maroon family. And they own the Ambassador Bridge. So all the tolls, all everything goes to this one family. The family's private corporate headquarters is in Detroit. And so there's moves to like build another one, and there's actually it's been starting for a while. I know in Windsor a whole street was kind of bought out to make room for this new bridge. But yeah, so that's one thing that I learned. Also, before going to the festival, I wanted to go and like, you know, take pictures and all that stuff, and so I had a lesson, and you know, sometimes the lure of filming graffiti is not a great thing. So, and I don't know if people know Detroit, but there's like the railway station, the old railway station, which is a beautiful building that's been derelict for like as long as I've been there. So, but there's like tons of graffiti, and so I wanted to go film it. Don't do that. So that was a lesson. I should have scouted a little bit more, but anyway.
Why not do it?
You'll get you. Yeah, security will come and, you know, give you a ticket or something. So anyway, and it's interesting because it's private security. So it's like the Canadian Pacific Railway security people. It's not even Detroit police, which is probably a good thing. Detroit police are not the greatest to interact with. So so I mean, that's like a little snippet of my trip. I don't know if that kind of was like rambling.
In terms of Detroit, when I lived there, Detroit was predominantly African American. Many people from Georgia, Tennessee, Alabama, primarily. Most people I knew were from Alabama or Georgia. I know that Berry Gordy's people came from Georgia. Smokey Robinson's people came from Alabama. And like many of the people that we know, I think Aretha Franklin was born in Tennessee. And we had people from Poland. Eastern European, and you know, there's a whole question of Hamtramck. I guess that was predominantly a Polish area. Then we always had a lot of Arabs in Detroit. For some reason, there was a lot of Arabs, and I remember, you know, there were some people from Yemen there at one point, and you know, Palestinians, and we had a relationship with the Palestinians, a good relationship with many Palestinians and many people from Yemen. But what does the community look like today in terms of the composition of the people? I guess there's Hispanics and, well, just what does what in terms of the mixture of the people, what does it look like today?
It's relatively small, and I believe that in Detroit, yeah, there's a lot of, you know, African people, and there's a lot of yeah, I think it's the biggest Arab population in the state, in the north, right? Yeah. So, and then I guess the people that I know there is like mostly, you know, African people, but, and yeah, Arab allies that I've organized with, but yeah, and then. But there's a lot of like flight right going on right now, so it's kind of, I guess, in flux. But yeah, no, it's very similar kind of thing.
Could you talk about the TV, radio, and the mass media? I think we have the daily papers, the Detroit Free Press and Detroit News, and then the do they have a paper like Now and the I and Michigan Chronicle, and I guess they have the Citizen TV. Could you talk about the you know, the mass media from a black and a general perspective? You know, like, what does it look like, the media look like in Detroit, Michigan in 2011?
I guess it's hard for me because I kind of compare it to the quantity of radio stations in Detroit is off the chain comparatively to Toronto. So even some of the and I'm unsure of the ownership. I would have to look into that, but there's just so many radio stations. And I don't know the actual infrastructure and how that kind of plays out. That's part of my research within my documentary. But there's so many specifically radio. There is so much diversity within the radio spectrum, and I don't know. You would know more of that about that. Do you know why that is?
No, because I haven't lived there, and I haven't lived there in 100 years, and I know that it's changed. And Detroit is, you know, you've had black mayors there, but I guess that's because a lot of the Europeans. I mean, basically, Detroit is what the people are terming like a failed city. So, you know, it's like a place that people really don't want. But no, in terms of, that's something I really would like to know. I know that WCHB, I don't even know if they're still there, public radio and all that kind of stuff. But no, I can't answer that. Is there, we wanted to take a music break and come back. I wanted to play a song that was recorded by a young man by the name of Harrison Kennedy in a group. They were based in Detroit. Give me just a little more time, but this is the first million seller that a black person from Canada was on. Harrison Kennedy was born in Hamilton. He still lives in Hamilton, Ontario, and this was the first million seller that a black Canadian was on. And this is Chairman of the Board featuring Harrison Kennedy.
Give me just a little more time. Just a little more time. And I'll surely grow. Give me just a little more time. Give me just a little more time. Just a little more time. And I'll surely grow. Just a little more time. Life's too short to make a mistake. Let's think of each other and hesitate. Young and impatient we may be. There's no if we part, our hearts won't forget it. Years from now, we'll surely regret it. Give me just a little more time, and I'll love for sure. Give me just a little more time, and I'll love for sure. You're young,
Give Me Just a Little More Time. That was the chairman of the board. That is General Johnson, Harrison Kennedy, and Danny Woods. And I'm in the studio with Melinda Francis, and we're talking about her recent visit to the Motor City, Detroit. And like Rap Brown said, they used to call it Motown. Now they call it No-Town. And we have a new governor of Michigan by the name of Snyder. And he is really causing a lot of consternation among African people and working people. I mean, everybody. I mean, he is. Give us a 411 on what is his first name?
His name is Rick Snyder, and this basically what started happening soon after the Wisconsin governor did the same kind of draconian like policies. So Rick Snyder brings in into law where the Michigan legislature passed a financial martial law bill that allows Snyder to appoint emergency financial managers with the power to terminate collective bargaining agreements. The bill would authorize the emergency manager to reject, modify, or terminate one or more terms of any existing contract. After meeting and conferring with the appropriate bargaining representative, and if the emergency manager's sole discretion, a prompt and satisfactory resolution were unlikely to be obtained. So basically, it's kind of very similar to Wisconsin, where it's kind of defuncting any collective bargaining within municipalities. So anyway, the people I was staying with, they were involved in there was a mass, there was a occupation of the legislature, so there was a sit-in. So there was, like, opposition to it. There was not much in the press comparatively to the Wisconsin mobilizations, but it did happen in Michigan as well. So I'm trying to get a follow-up to that, but I think I'm believed that it has passed, and all the people who were in the sit-in were arrested. So, and they're still kind of working on that. So, it's ongoing, and I think it's like sort of like a trend within all the states, which is kind of scary. Which it's kind of interesting how. Yeah, it's just an interesting trend right now. Like, it seems like it's like a domino effect.
In your project, your music project, are you talking about any of the resistance to what is taking place? Are you dealing with strictly genres of music, and the fact that Detroit has been a creative center of one of the most creative centers, I guess we can say, in the world? I mean, when we think about Detroit, we think about you know, a lot of great, not just Motown, but a lot of great musicians. Period. And so, is your project going to talk about the resistance of Detroit as well as the music, or just the music?
No, that's exactly. It's I guess framing the angle of my film is. Music within that framework, within resistance movements. So, and because there has been so much resistance within Detroit in its past history, looking at that's the reason why there's so much music there. It's a form of resistance. So, yeah, that's part of my film.
Well, some people have characterized Detroit as sort of Haiti-like. Because, you know, you had a rebellion in Detroit in the 30s. You had one in 1967. You had a lot of general strikes, wildcat strikes in the 60s, which led to the formation of DRUM, the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement. And then that grew into the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. And you know, we had many types of music that came out of there. Like, I know that there was a show on Black Agenda Radio where they talked about the fact that the Detroit was known for music. And, you know, when people think about Detroit, they think about Smokey Robinson and Aretha Franklin. But this guy, who was a music teacher, I think he was in his 80s, and he was basically making the point that Detroit had produced a lot of musicians that could read music. And they were into classical music and jazz music. And he talked about people like Ron Carter, who played with Miles Davis, and Della Reese, and what's her name, Jerry Allen, and people like that. How all of these people could read music, but the Detroit school system was getting ready to destroy all of the music programs. Instead of having bands in each school, they were going to have one band, and that was going to basically cause, Detroit is, and he talked about how music, contrary to popular belief, music can help people learn academically. And he also bragged about the fact that, you know, Detroit had produced a number of intellectual people. I think, what's his name, came out of it, was born in Detroit. What's the guy's name? Ralph Bunche, who I'm not a fan of, but I mean, Ralph Bunche was, I don't know if he won the first black person, he was the first black person to win a Nobel Peace Prize, but supposedly he made it in the society. I think he was a traitor, but that's neither here nor there. But could you talk about that whole question of, the Detroit public school system, were people talking about that?
Whenever I go back to Detroit, there's another school closing. So definitely that's sort of like a trend. And the thing is, if you see the music as like sort of a form of resistance, it makes sense. That would be an attack. That would be attacked, right? So if it's a form where people can express resistance, obviously that's the first thing that is going to be attacked. I feel that people are resilient, and that sort of can be filled within amongst the grassroots, and has to be to sort of continue that resistance. The public school system, every time I go there, there's another high school closing. So that's definitely an attack on working people. So
is there anything else you'd like to add?
Just stay tuned, and I'll update you guys on developments in Detroit and on the project. And if people are interested, hit me up. And and if you know any underground or resistance musicians in Detroit, let me know. And I'll look them up.
All right, I just wanted to say that Detroit. Motown Records is known for, the Miracles and the Temptations and so on and so forth. But Berry Gordy, Motown, had a label called Black Form. And on Black Form, they recorded speeches of Dr. King. Dr. King recorded the March on Washington speech, basically was done in Detroit before it was done in Washington. They also did an album on Huey Newton was in prison, and Stokely Carmichael spoke in Oakland, California. That speech was recorded and was on the Motown Black Form label. Also, Amiri Baraka did something for Black Form. Annie Lane Brown's music was on the Motown label. So, you know, there was more than just, love songs on Motown, although I think Mr. Gordy was forced into that situation, but he capitulated nevertheless. And we're going to play some music from Hamilton, Ontario. This is Harrison Kennedy without the chairman of the board, and Harrison Kennedy still is based here in Ontario. He's in Hamilton, and we're going to listen to Mr. Harrison and then come back with Amanla.
Oh, hugging my pillow, pain in my head. I couldn't sleep last night, 'cause it hurt so bad. That's alright, I'll pull through, because everybody gets a blues. You can run, but you can't hide. Blues gon' run right by your side. That's alright, you pull through, because everybody gets a blues. Got little tears on my pillow, I got a worry in my ear. I'd like to take that vacation, thinking about for such a long time. You can run, can't hide, who's gonna run right by your side. That's alright, you pull through, because everybody gets a blues. Just leave all the trouble behind. But wait a minute, you can run, you can't hide. We're gonna run right by your side. That's alright, I'll pull through, because everybody gets a blues. That's alright, I'll pull through, because everybody gets a blues.
Hi, my name is Jane Cortez. June is Black Music Month, the month we recognize reggae, calypso, and the rhythms of Mama Africa. It is the month we also recognize gospel, blues, rhythm and blues, jazz, and hip-hop. Join the Toronto chapter of the Black Music Association in the celebration of Black Music Month. Remember, June and every month is Black Music Month on CKLN FM 88.1.
Tukia basi aga shangana beat. Top shangani family sing. Jump. Sing. Ho. Drop your heart. Drop your heart. Drop your heart. Drop your heart. Yoga.
Jump.
Jump.
And you're listening to CKLN. This is Saturday Morning Live. My name is Norman Richmond, and we are going to, Manla is not in today. We're going to have a musical. We're going to deal with some music from, first from Nova Scotia, from Halifax, Nova Scotia, and then we're going to take you to Senegal. But the music from Senegal will feature Ernest Ranglin out of Jamaica. We're going to listen to Baba Mao and Ernest Ranglin. But first, we're going to hear from Shante Grant, who is from Nova Scotia, and she's going to tell us the story of Africville in music.
This song is for Mr. Brown, the first resident of Africville. This song is for Mr. Brown, the first settler of Africville, Mr. Brown, can you hear me calling your name against the wind? Mr. Brown, I went down to the shores of the Bedford Basin looking for you, but Africville could not let me in. Some of the people's plots was replaced by a park bench. Some of the people's lands is a children's playground. I don't know what the city was thinking when they come to Africville to chop them down. Built a string of condos called White Mountain over Africville. Built a string of condos over stolen ground today. Built a string of condos called White Mountain over Africville. But where's the black community that they brought down? This song is for Mr. Brown, the first resident of Africville. This song is for Mr. Brown, the first settler of Africville. Mr. Brown, can you hear me? I'm calling your name against the wind. Mr. Brown, I went down to the shores of the Bedford Basin looking for you, but Africville could not let me in. Replaced by a park bench. Some of the people's lands is a children's playground. I don't know what the city was thinking when they come to Africville to chop them down. Built a string of condos called White Mountain over Africville. Built a string of condos over stolen ground. I said there sits a string of condos called White Mountain over Africville. Where's the black community that they brought down? Where is Mr. Brown?
Today, I felt Africville. I've heard the stories about how their land was taken away and how they were forced out, how they were displaced from their homes, but today, I felt Africville. Sickened to my stomach, watching dogs pee on trees that were once climbed, watching mothers and their husbands take their children out of their car, unstrap their dogs from its leash, and run free through the backyards of the people who once lived in Africville. I see families. None of them are black.
I look around this place and think about all those great memories that went through here and that lives on through our souls and our hearts. I mean, it's in our bloodline. It just makes me sick thinking about them bulldozers and trucks that came in and took out my people and their homes. Think about all those children and their families.
I could not imagine someone taking my home, the place I grew up, where I took my first step. Destroying my life because what I cared about the most was my community and being able to walk down to so-and-so's with my friends or going to the community store or just hearing my mom or grandmother say, get up for church, and being able to walk to church because it was only down the hill. Being able to go...
It saddens me to know I'll never really know Africville. No matter what color you are or where you're from, find out what you can about her. Take a walk through where she used to lay. Imagine her life and her death. Imagine the moving people, the children playing, hymns being sung, and the love being pumped through her veins. Imagine
Africville. Africville. Were you ever here? I see pictures of you in textbooks. I see documentaries of you at school. And to think a city that prides itself on hospitality would tear down a community like such.
Seaview Park? A place to walk your dog while it poops all over the ground? No, I don't think so. I will continue to call it Africville, a place called home to many, including some of my own blood. My great-grandmother was a Carvery, a common last name from this community. She passed away before I was born, but my mother and my grandmother can tell me stories about her growing up in her home, Africville. As I stand here by this park bench, that at one time could have been a porch step, I think about family and how I would have fit in. And then I see two dogs running across.
Any other historical sites won't allow dogs, are covered with information, and where things are missing, pictures are there for all to see. But when I come here, all I can think is, what was this place? What was Africville, and why is there a welcome sign? Who is Tibby, and where is her pond? And why does the memorial reflect an accident instead of an incident involving a great injustice to our people? There was no fire, no flood, no natural disaster, no explosion or great conflict. Homes were bulldozed and people were forced out. Why aren't these stories told when I set foot on this soil? Why does this place say dog park with no history? It should be in my face. What happened to this place?
Train track? Dump? Rat? An infectious diseases hospital. Not the norm for your everyday community. Not even a place you would think of visiting. But for some, this was home. A home to raise your children. A home to feel a sense of belonging and love. A connection. A post office. A church. A home to share and create memories. The memories that linger forever. Some good, some bad, but all are important to the history of this place called Africville. A home, a community, a people.
This song comes from the north of Senegal, near the river Senegal. Late in the night, after all the works in the fields on the river, like everywhere in that part of Africa, my grandmom used to sit down. All the child of that big family, they come and sit down around her. And she used to say and to tell stories, stories who talk about our past, where we come from, the movement of all the ethnic groups from West Africa. And all the way through the stories, she used to sing a lot of songs. I picked just one of them. Very simple, a surprise for all the children all over the world, Cody.
Yeah.
Alia,
Thank you. mountain, Adio. Yelling, Adio, Minadi, Adio. What's your money, Domin, Adio? Edin and Garderio, Adio. Edin and Garderio, Adio. Pendo, Oinina, Tatuga.
You're listening to CKLN. June is Black Music Month. And so far, Rob Ford, Mayor Rob Ford, who I accidentally bumped into the mayor at City Hall. I was coming in the elevator, and he was walking out, and he was very kind. He spoke to me. And for whatever that's worth. But so far, Rob Ford has not proclaimed June Black Music Month. We've always had Black Music Month proclaimed by the mayor of Toronto, except when Mayor Lastman refused. Well, we didn't even ask him because he made a statement about going to Mombasa, Kenya, and he was talking about he was afraid that they might put him in a pot. And we used to always love to say publicly, especially the larger the audience were, we would like to say that Mel Lastman they would not put him in a pot in Mombasa because they are Muslims and they don't eat pork, so he was safe, and that would always get a laugh. But since 1993, the mayors of Toronto have proclaimed June Black Music Month, except for 2 years when we didn't even bother to deal with Mr. Lastman. So we will see whether or not Mayor Ford is going to proclaim June Black Music Month, but we proclaim June Black Music Month with or without Mayor Ford or the President of the United States, Barack Hussein Obama. Barack Hussein Obama has changed Black Music Month to African American Appreciation Month, which sounds like in North America, I don't know about Canada, but I can only speak coming from the United States. We had what we call music appreciation classes where I never went, but they would teach you to listen to Bach and Beethoven and Rachmaninoff and people like that, whom I grew to like some classical music, I must admit. But you know what? We rebelled against a lot of classical music when we were younger. And it might have been a mistake, but nevertheless, they gave us in the ghetto. They let us listen to, they had this music appreciation classes. And Mr. Obama seems to be doing the same thing. But we lost many people. Last week we were talking about the loss of Gil Scott-Heron. I just spoke to Randy Weston, who is coming to Toronto on June the 26th. And he said that Ray Bryant, a great pianist, we'll try to get something on from him, he passed away. But I received an email from Robin Battle, and we knew that Geronimo has just passed away. Geronimo Gijaga Pratt, or Elmer Pratt, Geronimo Gijaga. And Geronimo Gijaga was given the name Gijaga from Al Prentice Bunchy Carter. And Al Prentice Bunchy Carter was the deputy minister of the Black Panther Party for Southern California. And when he was assassinated, he left a tape saying that he wanted Geronimo to replace him. And Geronimo was in prison for 27 years. He was defended by several lawyers, including Johnny Cochran. But he left the United States and he moved to Tanzania. He moved to East Africa and he passed away. And for you gossip, well, I shouldn't say gossip, but for you, a little tabloid information, Geronimo was married to Kathleen Cleaver's daughter, Eldridge Cleaver, and Kathleen's daughter, who was born in North Korea, and she was given her name by Kim Il-sung's wife. She has a Korean name, but Geronimo left his wife and a couple of children. But Geronimo, I never met Geronimo. He came to Toronto one time, and he left early. I was supposed to meet him, and he came here doing something with Johnny Cochran, I believe, but I missed him. But we're going to listen to Geronimo Gijaga talk about the first time he met Al Prentice Bunchy Carter.
I never forget. I used to teach knife throwing in the Army. I always do a knife, and bayonet throwing. So I'm standing there in the front yard of this house on Smiley Drive, throwing my knife. I threw underhand into this tree, I guess about 10 paces away, and I go get it, and I'm throwing, and Al is inside the house. The next thing I know, I noticed a brother coming with a bad natural, and he had this sister with him. This was one of the most beautiful sisters I had. She had a woolly belly. And they was coming down a walkway, because it had a cyclone fence between the sidewalk. And so I'm, waiting to speak. I'm from down home. I'm going to speak to you, but I'm doing what I'm doing. So when I throw, and they come in, I notice he's coming in. And I'm kind of looking at Marva, that was her name, this fine sister with the miniskirt. But the brother, he goes to my knife, and he pulled it out the tree. And he come back to me, he smiled, looked at him, and we hadn't, no words were ever passed. By then, Al Jackson is standing on the porch, looking, smiling. And I don't say nothing, he spoke maybe, but Bunchy came back to where I was standing, and threw that knife over his shoulder and landed almost exactly where I had thrown that knife. And I smiled and walked up and went and got the knife and pulled it out. And I came back to him, took 2 paces back further. Now, all this is happening without us saying nothing. Ask Al. A bunch of go get the knife, come back 2 paces where I was at, threw it, and it bounced because the knife came toward Marva. And that's when the silence was broken. We all start talking. And Al said, hey, you finally met. And that's when the Donna went, oh, this is Bunchy. This is who I'm supposed to meet. That's how we met.
Demonic deceivers dared to call it a shootout. A shootout. An exchange of shots between two or more people or groups of people. A shootout. Nah. This was an extermination, an assassination, an immolation, a butchering, a murder, a Monroe massacre. An execution of illicit orders to seek out and destroy a movement, the movement of a man named Fred. But this was not someone whose legacy can start with his death. This was a man, the man with a plan, a strength, a vision to build a better world. based on love and a love for a people, all power to the people. Let's talk about friends. I keep seeing those signs, those banners, those reminders of we will never forget December 7th, 1949, September 11th, 2001, and the blind that care ensure that we never do. We will never forget, but most who won't don't even know the whole story. The night that the Japanese attacked, Franklin D. Roosevelt laid down with his wife and fell soundly asleep. When the news came that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor, she reported that he became, in a way, more serene. At least 11 months in advance, and as late as a few hours before, Franklin D. Roosevelt had explicit details on the planned attack. On the night before the Taliban attacked, George W. Bush laid down with his riches and fell soundly asleep. When the news came that the first tower had been hit, Bush waved away his security detail and finished reading a storybook to a classroom of school children. At least 3 months in advance, and as late as the time after the first plane hit, W had explicit details of the planned attack. The night before Fred's assassination, he laid down with his lady while talking on the phone with his mother and curiously fell asleep mid-sentence. When the city search and death squad came, Fred remained asleep amid heavy gunfire until wounded. He was shot twice in the back of the head and thrown into the bedroom doorway. Those bastards knew. Fred knew nothing. Yeah, we will never forget December 4th, 1969, the assassination of Chairman Fred Hampton. Let's talk about Fred. Let's talk about Fred. The high school honor graduate, the Triton Junior College pre-law major, the NAACP Youth Council leader who was able to organize over 500 youth from the NAACP's considerable membership in his early pursuits of social change through nonviolent activism. Fred, the outspoken, influential threat. Threat to hunger, how dare he try and feed hundreds of impoverished school children for breakfast. Well-fed children may think better. Threat to disease. What do you mean, free health clinic? Healthy people may live better. A threat to social ignorance, political education classes for whom? And aware people may free themselves. Free themselves, free themselves, free themselves. No, don't. Don't listen to Fred, don't listen to Fred, don't listen to Fred. You niggas are already free. You can already earn for, vote for, live next to, drink from the same water fountain as anybody else. Beyond that, you're just being greedy and insatiable. Don't listen to Fred, don't listen to Fred, don't listen to Fred. The violence inciter, the agitator, the gangbanger who looked as if he could turn Chicago gangs into a political organization, much like the old Irish Hamburg gang that launched Old Man Daly's career. The common thug, Burstin' Mal, Shay, Garvey, socialism, community need, global suffering perpetuated by capitalistic Americanism upon all people. All power to the people. Let's talk about friends.